Intelligent design and DNA. Scholars can't explain it all away. Get ready to be awed by the handiwork of God. Tune in to Real Science Radio. Turn up the Real Science Radio. Keeping it real.
Greetings to the brightest audience in the country. Welcome to Real Science Radio. I am Bob Enyart, the pastor of Denver Bible Church. You know, for 25 years, we've been doing a daily talk show on a 50,000-watt radio station. And we sort of get spoiled because we could call a publisher, a PR firm, and get a book, the latest book, and we don't have to pay for them usually. Well, a few weeks ago, my producer contacted an organization to ask them for a copy of a book on apologetics. They happily sent it out, and after I read the first chapter, it's titled Stealing from God, I realized this was so much fun and such an important book that I had to purchase another copy. I went online to Amazon. I bought the Kindle version and for a few extra dollars, the audio also, so I wouldn't have to put it down when I got into the car. The book, Stealing from God, by famed apologist Frank Turek, is a celebration of reason against the misinformation of the atheist. It brings you on a tour through today's battleground for the hearts and minds of a generation. And it leaves you confident of the victory, not only of the future victory in Christ, but also of that same victory right here and now, including the victory of science and logic and reason that all point to God as the source of all things. So it's such a fun book. You'll definitely want to enjoy it. And what an honor right now to have with us the author of, well, one of his other books, I Don't Have Enough Faith to Be an Atheist, and now of his latest book, Stealing from God, Dr. Frank Turek. Dr. Turek, welcome to Real Science Radio.
Hey, Bob, great being with you. And I want to point out that Stealing from God is not about tithing, okay?
I love it.
The subtitle is Why Atheists Need God to Make Their Case.
Yes.
So it's not about tithing. Not that there's anything wrong with tithing, but I just want to point out this is a book that,
and that is
to show you why Christianity is true and why atheism can't be true.
And tithing is a topic for another show, maybe
right.
On a Theology
right.
Thursday show. But, Frank, the book is so fun, and there's a theme that runs throughout it, that when the atheist makes an argument, he is absolutely refuting himself. If his argument were valid, it proves that he's wrong, which
yes.
We have to stretch our mind around that kind of thinking. But could we start with a bit of a discussion from your first chapter one on the law of causality? Everything that has a beginning must have a cause, and every effect must have a cause.
Exactly. There's some atheists out there, in light of the fact that the universe had a beginning, even they are admitting that. Even Stephen Hawking says almost everyone now believes that the universe and time itself had a beginning. Well, if that's really the case, then it seems it must have had a beginner. But there's some atheists out there trying to say, oh, no, the universe came into existence without a cause. Well, if that's the case, if things can pop into existence out of nothing, by nothing, without a cause, then why doesn't everything do so?
Right.
Right? I mean, why don't Mercedes-Benzes and MacBook Pros
and Boltzmann
and mansions pop into existence out of nothing, by nothing, without a cause? Because we know the universe doesn't work that way.
Mm.
And if everything in the universe needs a cause, the universe itself needs a cause. Otherwise, you can't do science, Bob. I mean, because as you know, science is a inquiry to discover cause and effect relationships. And if the law of causality doesn't hold, then you can't even do science.
You can't do science, and much of this is anti-science. I had on the show some of the folks you know, Dr. Turek. We've had on the show Michael Shermer, Eugenie Scott, Lawrence Krauss. And I started out asking Krauss, like the subtitle of his book, Why Is There Something Rather Than Nothing?
Mm-hmm.
He immediately equivocated and said, well, of course, we're here talking on the phone, so we know there's something. That wasn't really the question, that we know there's something, but why is there something?
And what Krauss tries to say is that the nothing from which the universe came was a quantum vacuum, which doesn't explain where the quantum vacuum came from. I mean, the quantum vacuum is something, So well, Krauss tries to say you can get a universe from nothing, but his nothing isn't really nothing. It's something.
Well,
so
he's
not answering the question.
Right, exactly. And physicists have blasted Lawrence Krauss for this and the equivocation and the lack of logic and reason in their claims. Of course, he's close with Richard Dawkins, but another famous atheist, a physicist, Stephen Hawking, said something similar, that the universe comes from nothing. It creates itself from nothing because of the law of gravity. And John Lennox just so enjoys pulling that apart and showing all the contradictions just on page one of Stephen Hawking's latest book.
Yeah, well, first of all, gravity is something. It's not nothing. And secondly, gravity can't do anything. Gravity just does the same thing over and over again. It can't create something. So Hawking's case doesn't work, or his explanation for the beginning of the universe doesn't work. The universe, if space, matter, and time had a beginning, which even Hawking admits, then whatever caused the universe can't be made of space, matter, and time. In other words, it must be spaceless, timeless, immaterial, powerful to create the universe out of nothing, personal in order to choose to create, also intelligent because this universe is fine-tuned. Now, when you think about a spaceless, timeless, immaterial, powerful, personal, intelligent cause, who do you think of? That's what we mean by God.
Well, Frank, when the atheist, whether it's Krauss or whoever, will object when we argue that the universe, everything that has a beginning must have a cause, therefore the universe must have a cause, they'll object to that, but then they immediately apply it to God. And they say, if that's true, then God must have had a cause.
No, we don't say everything has a cause. Everything that comes to be has a cause. There has to be something that didn't come to be. There has to be a self-existing cause. Aristotle called it the unmoved mover. Atheists for many years called it the universe. You see, atheists had no problem believing in an eternal universe, but now suddenly they have a problem believing in an eternal God. Well, why is that? Because God brings moral authority with him and the universe doesn't. Maybe that's the reason why. So everybody believes in an uncaused first cause. The only question is, what is the uncaused first cause? Is it the universe or something outside the universe? And since the universe had a beginning, it must be something outside the universe, and that being must be spaceless, timeless, immaterial, powerful, moral, personal, intelligent, all the attributes that we would call God.
If matter and energy had a cause, then matter and energy, they're not the likely suspects for what caused matter and energy.
Right, exactly.
You don't cause yourself. Basically, they're arguing against a stone idol. You know, and the Bible also argues against the stone idol. It comes into existence. But the Christian God, if you're going to rebut a belief system, then you have to rebut that belief system, not some other system. So when Christianity, the God of the Bible, asserts that God existed throughout all of eternity, then they need to argue against that if they're going to succeed.
They do, and they can't. That's the problem. Look, at the end of the day, either matter came from mind or mind came from matter. And if you think about it long enough and you look at the evidence, you'll realize that matter came from mind, that the ultimate reality is mind, not matter. Mm. Matter had a beginning. Matter changes. Matter will go out of existence. But mind, an immaterial mind, is ultimately the foundation of everything that exists. Mm. And that's what we mean by God.
I want to jump to chapter 2 in a second. But first, you use the law of causality in a way that I don't see commonly used. I wanted to ask you, how common is it among apologists and Christian philosophers to apply the law of causality to arguing from a premise to a conclusion?
I don't know how common it is. It just seems to make sense to me, because the objection that the atheists are saying is cause and effect only occurs with physical things.
Right.
The problem is that if that were the case, then premises in an argument wouldn't work. For example, all men are mortal, Socrates is a man, therefore Socrates is mortal. Is an argument.
Yeah.
Well, there's no physical connection between the premises, but the logic works. Mm. Well, if there's no physical connection between the premises, yet the logic works, then the law of causality isn't just physical. It also works on metaphysical things, things beyond the physical. Mm. In fact, Lawrence Krauss tries to say every effect has a physical cause. Well, if that's the case, just look at his book, the book that he wrote. Did his book have a physical cause? You say, yeah, his brain. Well, if it's just his brain and he doesn't have a mind, just his brain, why should we believe anything in his book as being true? Because if his brain is completely governed by the laws of physics, in other words, he doesn't have a mind, he just has a brain, then why should we believe anything he thinks?
Yeah.
It's not really him telling us that the universe came from nothing. It's just physics. It's just physics working on matter in his brain. In other words, there's an immaterial reality to our minds that can't be explained completely by the laws of physics. And if that's the case, then every cause isn't always physical. Sometimes it's immaterial. And if it's immaterial, the law of causality applies. We explain in Chapter 2.
We're speaking with Frank Turek. The book is Stealing from God. Frank, I think you'll be able to hear this fine. I'd like to play for you the first 40 seconds or so of my interview with Lawrence Krauss, and maybe we could point out a couple things. Let's hear this.
So if I end up disagreeing with you on a point, and you're able, with your knowledge, to confirm that there are many scientists who would agree with me, could you let the audience know? Because I might need your help in refuting you.
Sure, yeah, as long as we're, if we're talking science,
yeah,
absolutely.
If we're talking science, you're a best-selling author. So I'd like to say to you that this is a well-written book, but that's a bit like telling a girl you met on a blind date that she has a great personality. Because I so disagree with what you write, but between you and Richard Dawkins, you guys concede fully half of the argument to us creationists.
And so, Frank, the half of the argument, it was very difficult then to get it out, but eventually we were able to get there, that the world's most famous atheist biologist and the world's most famous atheist physicist, they admit that everything looks like it was designed. The universe and every biological organism, they look like they were designed.
In fact, they do, and even both of them admit that you could make a case for a deistic God. That there is a cause out there. The problem is if they admit deism, it's a very short step to theism. You see, deist, for those of you that may have heard the term but not quite sure what it means a God that created the world, set up the laws of nature, but doesn't get involved. Well, a theistic God is a God who created the universe, set up the laws of nature, and gets involved and stays involved. And it's easy then to see later that, yes, God doesn't just create the universe and then leaves it. God creates the universe, sustains it, and intervenes in it. And that's what we cover in other chapters of the book.
Well, in Chapter 2 on reason, you talk about non-material reality. And it is so exhilarating to realize that math, morality, the rules of grammar, information, thought, intention, logic, these are not material. And yet they describe fundamental reality. They help us understand morality, and we argue with these non-material laws.
Yeah, in fact, one of the reasons the book is called Stealing from God, Why Atheists Need God to Make Their Case, is most of atheists today are materialists. They think all that exists are materials. You know, what's on the periodic table, hard matter. The problem is the very laws they use to make that point are immaterial. And the very laws they use, say, to debate me or you, Bob, are immaterial. The laws of logic are immaterial. So as soon as they open their mouth to try and debate, they're actually losing the debate, because to say everything is material is false, because the very statement everything is material is immaterial. And the laws of logic they use to try and make that statement are immaterial.
Now,
that's why they're stealing from God while they're arguing against him. That's the premise of the book. And we don't just do that for a reason. There's an acronym going through the book, CRIMES, causality, reason, information, morality, evil, and science. That atheists think that causality, reason, information, morality, evil, and science point toward atheism, but the truth is causality, reason, information, morality, evil, and science wouldn't exist unless God existed. That's the whole premise of the book.
And I've been debating on the air atheists for 25 years. We go to college campuses, high school campuses, and the intolerance is palpable. It used to be, and I'm not the first to observe this, if you said Jesus Christ is the only way to salvation, they would say, prove it. Today they say, what right do you have to say that? In Chapter 3 of your book on information and intentionality, and I love that you emphasize intention, but I've had atheists argue that information is physical, that the laws of logic are physical, as absurd as that is. that thoughts are physical, and you point out that no matter how much a neurologist learns about our brain, he will never be able to look in your brain and see what you are thinking.
No, there's no way you could ever prove materialism. Why? Because the very people doing the experiments have to assume they're not just moist robots. They're not just materialistic beings. Otherwise, any data that they get from their experiments and any reasoning they use to interpret that data, if it's all completely governed by the laws of physics, there's no reason to believe that their experiments are true. Mm. In other words, any attempt to prove through neuroscience that the mind is the brain has to assume the mind isn't the brain. Because the very people doing the experiments have to assume they have a mind and not just the brain. If they have just the brain, then why should we believe anything they think? Because they're just completely governed by the laws of physics.
A neurologist recently pointed out when you show somebody a picture of a chair and you're monitoring their brain waves and you see part of their brain gets active. You show them another picture of a chair and there's that part of the brain active. And then you tell them, talk about the word sit. And they think about sit and chair, just those two things, and their brain lights up like a cathedral on Christmas Eve. It's just the whole brain goes wild. And to think that we're going to be able to succeed in a reductionist approach to seeing neurons firing, being activated, and then understand mind and identity, who I am, and then the laws of logic and so on. And as though you point out in the book, that as the chemistry in your brain changes, that doesn't change the laws of logic. And no, it doesn't change who you are as a
right,
person.
Right, that's the other point in there. And the book is called Stealing from God. It's chapter 2, I think you're in now, Bob. And that's where we say that the idea that you're just a material being is disproven by a number of points. One of the points is what you just mentioned there. You know, your molecules change over every 7 or 15 years, depending upon which study you believe. If that were the case, if you were just a completely material being, you wouldn't be able to remember anything longer than 15 years ago, right?
Because
your molecules
person.
Have completely changed. Secondly, the placebo effect shows that you have a mind and not just a brain. In other words, there's causality from the mind to the brain. If you just think you're getting medicine, sometimes you get better. So the mind there is actually affecting your physical brain. We know that your brain, your physical brain, affects your immaterial mind, but sometimes your immaterial mind affects your physical brain and your body. The placebo effect shows that. The very fact that much of our disease is stress-induced, what you think about can actually change your physical structure.
That's just awesome. We've had Stephen Meyer on the show, Paul Nelson, so many of the guys from the Discovery Institute up in Seattle, and they talk about information all the time, but your information and intentionality, and they do talk about the intent of the designer, but I think that is such an important thing to stress. We had an atheist, a written debate and an on-air debate. His name is Aaron Ra from Texas. Mm-hmm. He's a very angry atheist. But I made the point that forensic science, they could look at a death and say, this was not natural causes. In other words, there was a murderer. And he jumped all over that and said, even murder is natural. Everything we do is natural. And he was obfuscating. He was equivocating because the point was intent. Forensic science, they can go back and they could see that a death was not by natural causes, but there was an intent to kill someone, an intent to stop their heart from pumping. And that kind of equivocation seems to be ubiquitous, regardless of what famous atheist I'm listening to or reading.
Yeah, if you're walking along the beach and you see in the sand John loves Mary, you immediately assume there had to be an intelligent being. You don't go, the waves did that, or crabs came out and made that message, because messages always come from minds. Well, inside of every one of your 40 trillion cells, there's a message that's 3.5 billion letters long. All the letters are in the right order. Or even Bill Gates said, and he, you know, he's no Christian, he said DNA is like a software program, but it's far more designed than anything we've ever designed ourselves.
Way more sophisticated, yeah.
Where I come from, if there's a program, there must be a programmer. If there's a code, there must be a coder. If there's a message, there must be a messenger. And so the message inside of every one of our cells shows that there has to be an intelligent designer out there.
We don't have a lot of time. Chapter 4 is on morality, chapter 5 on the problem of evil. You talk about Dawkins in chapter 4, and he can't even really acknowledge that something as heinous as rape is actually objectively wrong. And he brags that he's a passionate anti-Darwinist when it comes to leading our lives, because Darwinism, of course, survival of the fittest. You could just kill the weak and take their possessions if you wanted to. But I have here about a 25-second clip from Dawkins. Maybe you could hear this, Frank. He's talking to Peter Singer, who is a notorious bioethicist who said that a newborn is as valuable as a pig or a dog. And Peter Singer is nodding in approval at Dawkins when Dawkins is affirming infanticide, killing babies up to age 1 or 2 if they're handicapped. Let's hear this.
The argument in favor of abortion up until the baby was 1 year old, say, or 2 years old. And so if a baby was 1 year old and turned out to have some horrible, incurable disease that meant it was going to die in agony in later life, what about infanticide? Strictly morally, I can see no objection to that at all. I would be in favor of infanticide.
And so, Frank, it seems that the atheist celebrates killing the innocent like a baby, but uncannily they seem to be opposed to the death penalty for executing the guilty.
And not only that, this is the same Richard Dawkins who is upset with the God of the Old Testament who decides to kill the Canaanites. So when God plays God in the Old Testament, he's immoral. But when Richard Dawkins plays God here today, that's a moral right for him.
Wow.
And I don't understand how you can justify that. Where is he coming up with morality anyway? He says that all we do is dance to our DNA. Look, he's a materialist. There is no right or wrong in an atheistic world. There is no morality. I mean, I'm not saying atheists can't be moral. I'm not saying atheists don't know morality.
Right.
I'm saying they can't justify it. If we're just molecular machines, there's no such thing as right or wrong.
Right.
That's the Achilles heel of atheism.
There are people who preferred to lynch blacks or kill Jews. They preferred it for their own survival.
Right.
And so atheism lacks any basis upon which to condemn that objectively.
Then what they do is they steal from God while they're arguing against him. He's just talking about morality, right or wrong, right there. Well, there is no morality if there is no God. So what does Dawkins have to do? He has to steal it from God while he's arguing there is no God. It's a self-defeating proposition. If anything's true, Bob, it's not atheism, okay? Now, you can make an argument for, you know, is Christianity true? We haven't done that here yet today. We don't have time, but I do in the book point out that, yes, Christianity is true, and here's why. So the book goes through why atheism can't be true and why Christianity is.
And Frank, another theme is the point is not that the argument for atheism fails, but rather if atheism were true, every argument fails.
That's right, because we're just moist robots. We're just molecular machines. We're not really arguing. We're not really reasoning. We're just reacting. So why believe anything we think?
Yeah, meet computers. So, Frank, what an enjoyable book. Thank you for writing this. It's an honor to have you on Real Science Radio. And your organization, could you just close telling us?
Sure. Crossexamined.org, one word, crossexamined.org. Check that out and also sign up for our Facebook page, crossexamined.org, and get our free app, two words in the App Store, CrossExamined, has all of our TV shows, radio shows on there, and even has a quick answer section for people who you're discussing Christianity with. They come up with an objection you can't answer. You'll have it right there on your phone in the CrossExamined app, so check it out.
And Frank, on our website, oh, by the way, John Lennox on a cruise to Alaska 2 years ago, I happened to be on that with Stephen Meyer and Paul Nelson, and what a great time. And I was introduced to Lennox, and he said, oh, you're the guy who wrote that article on Euthyphro. We've got our own, you know, article, A Christian Answer to Euthyphro's Dilemma. But on our show summary of today's program on our website, rsr.org, Real Science Radio, we'll link to your site, we'll link to your book, and you'll probably never get the time to come back to it. But if you do, I'd like to link just a couple challenges to some of the details in the book. I didn't want to take time on the air because I want to celebrate the success of your book and of your ministry. But if
you
ever get to
it, Bob,
it'll be on there. So thank you, Frank Turek.
Thanks for having me on.
All right.
God bless.
What an honor. That's Dr. Frank Turek. The book is Stealing from God. He's also the co-author of I Don't Have Enough Faith to Be an Atheist in the organization crossexamine.org. To find this show summary on our website, just go online to rsr.org/Frank Turek. That's pretty easy. Turek is T-U-R-E-K. So you could also abbreviate it, rsr.org/Turek, T-U-R-E-K. I highly recommend the book, the print edition, the Kindle, and also the audiobook. It's a lot of fun. You'll love it. You'll thank us for recommending it. Now, Dr. Turek had a hard deadline. He had to go, but we have a bit more time, so I'd like to discuss with you some of the notes that Frank Turek and I did not get to. I did bring up to him my question when he talks about the law of causality and cause and effect, and he applied it in a way that I have not seen. He applied it to the form of a logical argument. In other words, you have a premise, maybe another premise, and you draw a conclusion. And if you have a valid premise and a valid premise, and you reason soundly, you could draw a valid conclusion. Well, he used the law of causality to describe that. And I asked Frank if that was common among apologists and Christian philosophers to apply the law of causality to arguing from a premise to a conclusion, and he said he didn't know how common it may be. So I just wanted to point that out. That's interesting. When I think about that kind of claim, right? Like, here's a premise. Frank either wrote a book or flew to the moon. And then a second premise. Frank never flew to the moon, therefore the conclusion, therefore, he wrote a book. So that, I don't quite see the connection with the law of causality, that you reason from a premise to a conclusion, but perhaps that's just something that needs to be discussed and thought through by more people more extensively. Also, when we were discussing his chapter 6 on science, that chapter opens up with the discussion of O.J. Simpson. It's real interesting, and it talks about how some people, because of their worldview, they hear all the news, and they conclude that O.J. Simpson is not guilty, which is startling to those of us who actually looked and weighed the evidence. But if we had more time, I would have let Frank know that we went out. I went out with about, 10 of our audience members to Hollywood a few years back. And at auction, we purchased O.J. Simpson's memorabilia. That was his Hall of Fame award, his two jerseys that hung in his Brentwood home in his living room, the one he signed Heisman 68, and then his Buffalo Bills jersey. We spent about $14,000. And then we burned it all at high noon on the steps of the L.A. courthouse to make a statement that we should not honor murderers because other people wanted to buy this stuff to display it. And also we called for reform to our criminal justice system because so many murderers get away with their crime. By the way, you can see that at our website, realscienceradio.com/OJ. And you could actually see video of us burning the stuff. And I tell you, to get permission in Los Angeles to burn anything is a challenge. And then you want to try to burn something at the courthouse downtown on the steps of the courthouse. So we were told, oh, you got to go to the fire marshal. You need the chief fire marshal to approve this. So we went and he said, you can't burn anything. And he said, what do you want to burn? OJ stuff? He said, yeah, let me sign. Where do I sign? And then he said, but you're going to have to get permission of the chief judge at the courthouse because it's his courthouse. So we went to the chief judge. This was all done in 2 hours. It was like humanly impossible. And the judge said the same thing. You're not going to burn. What? You want to burn OJ stuff? Okay. Where do I sign? So they signed the permits. So that was good. In his chapter 6, in Stealing from God by Frank Turek, chapter 6, I'm so glad he brought up the demarcation problem. What is the demarcation problem? It's what is and what is not science. Because when you listen to intelligent design folks or creationists, it seems that often they just back into a particular definition of science, and they might state in passing what science is or is not, if it's observable, repeatable, whatever. And they typically don't even acknowledge that this is a loaded question in a hotly debated field of what is science, the demarcation problem. And folks will point out that science is only about finding natural causes, right? And so Frank Turek lists, for example, archaeology, cryptology, the study of codes, like in World War II, the Enigma machine and all, forensic science, information science, those do not have to do with finding natural causes. So obviously, there is science in doing real good science involved with forensics. You're trying to find out if a death was by natural causes or intentional, if someone killed another person. That's a fascinating topic. Like many creationists, Frank Turek talked about operational science and historical science. And online at our website, we have an article arguing that historical science is not a second-class science. It's not less reliable. It's not less true. In fact, you could read that at rsr.org/forensics. rsr.org/forensics. You know, operational science, it is said, this is something that can be repeated, observed and repeated. And Frank Turek says it's usually more certain than origin science. I wonder about that claim and even those terms that he used to say. It's usually more certain than origin science. So in other words, he's leaving room there for saying, well, sometimes historical science. So Frank Turek said that operational science is usually more certain than historical science or origin science. And his terminology there is interesting to me. It's usually more certain. In other words, he's leaving the door open for acknowledging that sometimes historical science is more reliable or more certain than operational science. And I would like to say this. Not only just more certain, but certain. Science can tell us things that are certain. And I know that's not popular to claim, but our article, rsr.org/forensics, deals with that question. C.S. Lewis, I would have loved to talk to Frank about C.S. Lewis' comments about scientific thinking. This is in his Christian Reflections, page 77, where Lewis wrote this: the physical sciences depend on the validity of logic just as much as metaphysics or mathematics. If popular thought feels science to be different from all other kinds of knowledge because science is experimentally verifiable, then popular thought is mistaken. I love C.S. Lewis. He's just brilliant. If you think scientific thought is different from everything else because science is experimentally verifiable, he says, then you're wrong. And he goes on. Experimental verification is not a new kind of assurance coming in to supply the deficiencies of mere logic. We should therefore abandon the distinction between scientific and non-scientific thought. The proper distinction is between logical and non-logical thought. And I absolutely Love that. Francis Bacon, Turek mentions, he's the father of the scientific method. And Turek points out that Francis Bacon says that science is a search for causes. Really a search for understanding, right? And a search for causes. And so when you're searching, if you look at design and nature, as Frank does, you could reason to a cause, which is intelligence. You see information. And I think that science includes mathematics. It's not real popular to include the mathematics department among the science departments, but I think that it rightly belongs there. So I'm going through my notes here to see what is of interest that maybe we could have touched on. In his book, Frank Turek relates conversations he's had with college students around the country after he has presented his talk in defense of the existence of God, of Christianity. And on more than one occasion, he's asked a student, typically an atheist, if Christianity were true, would you become a Christian? That is a fabulous question. If Christianity were true, would you become a Christian? And Frank tells of this one guy who said, no, no. And they brag, atheists brag, of being creatures of reason, that they follow the evidence, right? So what would your intellectual objection be if Christianity were true and you were a creature of reason, then you would object to it? And it turns out that the atheists, while they cloak themselves in these terms like brights and rationalists, League of Reason, where I debated Aaron Ra, a well-known atheist, in reality, they are bundles of emotion, and often anger and bitterness, resentment, and they don't want to submit their will to God. They don't care if there is a God. In fact, they don't want there to be a God, because even if they knew that God does exist, even if they knew that Christianity were true, they would still say, don't tell me what to do. So they are not on a truth quest. They're on a pleasure quest. They're on a happiness quest. They're on a pride or an ego quest. My producer and I went to Oxford this past fall to research for a debate on something called the King James Only movement. We debated against one of the leaders in that movement. And you can find that too online, rsr.org/King James. Or KJO. And while we were there, you know, Richard Dawkins teaches at New College at Oxford. So we dropped off something into his faculty mailbox, and it was a real nice printing. It's like a large postcard, and it's our Dawkins 3-to-1 evolution challenge. And I would have loved to talk about this with Frank Turek, but there's so little time and so many fun things to discuss. In this challenge to Dawkins, it's about genetics. And we say, let's set aside all the wild complexity of genetics, that whole field. And let's just look at one of the simplest aspects of the entire genetic scheme. And that is how every amino acid is identified by 3 genetic letters. That's why we call it the Dawkins 3-to-1 evolution challenge. So we ask Richard Dawkins, we have beautiful artwork of the DNA double helix, and you can see the nucleotides. And every 3 of those genetic letters code for 1 amino acid, and then the amino acids in the right order, they fold into a functional protein. And so we asked Dr. Dawkins, in as vague terms as you'd like, be vague, that's fine. Please describe how the 3-to-1 pattern could arise by materialist methods, whereby 3 genetic letters symbolize or code for one amino acid? How could that part of the whole scheme arise? And it's so much fun because as theist, as creationist, biblical creationist, we know that not only have the atheists not been able to answer that in the last half century, they will never be able to answer that. It is simply unanswerable based on the constraints that they put on themselves. Why? Because the laws of chemistry and the laws of physics lack symbolic logic functions. So there's no symbolism in the laws of chemistry. And that's why scientists have done such a fabulous job of figuring out chemistry and physics, because it's all very rudimentary. And reductionism works in those fields to a large degree. But when you come to biology, which is information-based, and information is symbolic, and when you close your mind to the reality that the information is there because it came from an intelligent source, the designer, the creator, then not only are you never going to be able to understand the origin of life, but also you wouldn't even be able to take a vague stab at explaining how any aspect of this symbolism could arise through natural means. It's utterly impossible for Richard Dawkins, after spending a lifetime teaching the world about methodological naturalism and neo-Darwinism and mutations and genetics and natural selection, none of it will help him at all answer the Dawkins 3-to-1 evolution challenge. By the way, you could find that graphic. It's beautiful artwork, nicely laid out, easy to understand, at our website, rsr.org/Dawkins, D-A-W-K-I-N-S. And while I mention that, let me just quickly tell you about something similar. It's our Evolution Vision Challenge. You know, a while ago, we did a P.Z. Myers Trochlea Challenge. P.Z. Myers is one of the more well-known evolutionists, and he responded to our challenge, and just like with the Dawkins challenge, we took one of the simplest parts of our human vision system, the superior oblique. It's a muscle attached to our eyeball, and it goes through a pulley. It's called the trochlea. It's like the simplest part of the whole thing. It helps your eyeball to turn. And we said, could you take everything you know about evolution and tell us how mutations and natural selection could lead to the development of the trochlea. You've got to see that artwork. That's really fun. You can see it at rsr.org/EYE. You'll love it. And P.Z. Myers responded, and he said, you know, I don't know. And that was honest of him. That was great that he said that. But Darwinists cannot explain the simplest, let alone the sophisticated aspects of the capabilities that God has endowed us with. And so one other that's on that same page, rsr.org/I, is our Evolution Vision Challenge. You have got to look at this. This is a depiction of what an insect would see, put the word see in quotes, if he was developing some rudimentary eye spot. He was developing a lens, a retina, whatever, and data, photons, were hitting it, and they were going down a nerve to his brain. And there in his brain is its own tiny insect visual cortex, and he's supposed to understand what it is he's seeing. And so consider what information is getting to that vision processing center in that insect's brain. Think about it, in that housefly's brain. What's getting in there? If you could go in and look, blow up his brain to the size of your house and go into the part where he interprets the light signals hitting his lenses. Let's say he's looking at a flower, and now you are in his brain. Are you going to see like a little screen or a flat screen TV and a projection on it of the flower? Is that what you're going to see inside his brain? The only thing you're going to see, so to speak, is a bunch of static. It's an electrical chemical signal, which varies a million times a second. And it's all symbolic logic, and it needs to be decoded. And so our retina, for example, encodes the visual data. It encodes it symbolically, sends it to our brain. Our retina is really part of our brain. It's like an extension of our brain. Pre-processing happens in your retina. You figure out the shapes of things in your retina and maybe even the pre-processing of whether there's a face looking at you from your peripheral vision. There's pre-processing going on in your retina. And so then the data gets sent down your optic nerve to your visual cortex. And there your brain decodes the symbolic logic. It's not just one part of your brain either, or it's happening all in different parts of your brain. And then it's being assembled in what is obviously the most sophisticated system known to mankind. And none of that could evolve because it's not based fundamentally on chemistry or physics. Fundamentally, it's based on symbolic logic. And there are no tools in the atheist toolbox to figure out how to deal with symbolism, symbolic logic, encoding and decoding information. Okay, so a few things that I disagree with Dr. Turek on. I wasn't going to mention this, but reading his book, I said to one of our family members a few days ago, I said, you know, Dr. Turek, he cannot mention God without using the word timeless. He just can't do it. And it won't it be a kick when he meets God face to face? He already knows God. He loves the Lord Jesus Christ. But won't it be a kick when he meets God face to face and he finds out that God has a past? Won't that be a kick? Because Aristotle, Plato, they argued that God, their pagan perverse conception of God, was timeless. And Augustine incorporated that into Christian theology. But God the Son, to use the biblical term before the foundation of the earth, the term that Frank Turek uses, that Calvinists use, that Molinists use, that Arminians use, that God uses in the Bible repeatedly, that everyone is allowed to use except for an open theist. We're the only ones that are not allowed to say before the foundation of the earth because they will complain, they being anyone who disagrees, and say, well, you can't say before. Well, God says before. But in eternity past, before the foundation of the earth, God the Son was not a man. He was not the Son of Man, but he became a man in the incarnation. In eternity past, God the Son had not suffered. He had not become a curse. He had not become sin for us. The Father had not poured out his wrath on the Son for eternity past. He's not doing it right now. He will not be doing it eternally in an eternal now. But God has a past, and God the Son existed for eternity past as a spirit, and then in the incarnation, he became flesh, dwelt among us, then he was crucified, then he was justified in the spirit because he became sin for us, not for his own sin, but for our sin. So as the epistle says, he was justified in the spirit, and then he ascended into heaven. And now God looks back on the cross, whereas like in Isaiah, God looked forward to the cross, and now he looks back. And Jesus is not eternally on the cross. So God has a past. You can see all of this so explicitly laid out from the Bible at our article on time, just rsr.org/time. In our interview, it was a broadcast event with a professor from Liberty University of Apologetics and Theology, Dr. Richard Holland. You'll love that. Just go to rsr.org/time. You'll find all of that. And then maybe one last thing. Not in the interview, but in his book, Dr. Turek advocates, he defends the Big Bang. And, you know, there are many Christians who believe in the Lord, but they defend Darwinism. And Frank Turek is not one of those. He sees that blind, the randomness that yields the mutations that Darwinism is based on, and then culled by natural selection, Frank Turek sees that that cannot explain the diversity of life on Earth. So he's not a Darwinist. But he does accept the cosmological mainstream account of how the universe got here. Not the origin of species, but the origin of solar systems, planets, stars, and galaxies. In fact, the universe itself, he does say that God started it, but then he defends the Big Bang. And of course, if we were to ask Frank for his best argument for the Big Bang as a theory, he probably would not do any better than NASA or the BBC or the Discovery Channel or 1,000 cosmologists and astronomers. And he would say what NASA says, that the Big Bang, the theory is confirmed, it's credible, because the theory makes predictions. And it's made three major predictions: the expansion of the universe, the elements created in the Big Bang, and the CMB, the microwave background radiation, the static of the universe. And therefore, we know the Big Bang is true because of its predictions having been confirmed by observation. Well, what's interesting is if Frank Turek Googled those three words, Big Bang predictions, he'd find that there's about 500,000 web pages that seem to be related to that search term. And the number one site, beating out Wikipedia, beating out NASA, beating out the Discovery Channel, beating out National Geographic, beating out the BBC, the number one site is Real Science Radio. In RSR's list of the Big Bang predictions. Then also, if he were to Google evidence against the Big Bang, he would find that Google ranks us somewhere on that very first page of results. And, you know, we move on that page. We've been number one for a time and up and down on the first page of results. The evidence against the Big Bang is overwhelming. The number of scientists, including atheists, who reject the Creator and have made discoveries and have said publicly, this challenges the Big Bang. This contradicts what we expected by the Big Bang model. They number in the hundreds. And Lawrence Krauss, when he was on this show, Real Science Radio, I brought up to him antimatter. And if the Big Bang were true, that energy was converted into matter at the time of the Big Bang, in 20 minutes, all the matter of the universe was made, that half of everything that exists in the universe should be antimatter. Instead of electrons, we should have half of it all should be positrons. Instead of protons, half of it all should be antiprotons. Instead of a hydrogen atom, half of all that should be antihydrogen atoms. And mainstream universities and institutions have acknowledged that an antimatter universe is empirically excluded. It doesn't exist. Half of all stars are not made of antimatter. Half of all galaxies, half of all nebula, It's not there. And so that is powerful evidence against the Big Bang that our friends at the Discovery Institute have never considered. And what Lawrence Krauss does, when he said to me, he said, I don't believe anything. Scientists don't believe anything. We just follow the evidence. Now, that's a lie, right? Because one of the things he believes is that when the Big Bang happened, even though when energy is converted into matter, theory tells us that it's converted in an exact proportion of 50-50. For exactly every electron, you're going to get exactly one proton. You're going to get exactly one positron. Exact. And when we do this in a lab and we experiment in our colliders, like the Hadron Collider over in Europe, you get exactly the same amount of matter as you get antimatter. And so it is faith, but better, it is blind faith for Lawrence Krauss to claim, as he does, that for every 50 million particles of antimatter, there were 50 million and one particles of matter. And so through the Big Bang, all the matter and antimatter annihilated itself, and you end up with just matter. Now, that is not science. That's not based on observation. That's not based on theory. That's based on the desperate need, a rescue device, to save a failed theory, the Big Bang. So if you Google evidence against the Big Bang, or you Google Big Bang predictions, you'll find Real Science Radio at our website, kgov.com, right at the top of those lists, because we have the best listing, simply the best catalog of all the evidence against the Big Bang in one place, on one page, on the entire internet. And I think you'll love that. I enjoyed speaking with Frank Turek. It was an honor to have him on Real Science Radio. Perhaps that will happen again. We're about out of time. Let me make a last plug for our 25th anniversary steak dinner at Shanahan's in Denver. It's $1,000 a plate. It's Friday night, June 3rd. And I know that's expensive. It's to help us stay on the air, if the Lord tarries, perhaps for another 25 years. But then also, the next day, Saturday, we have our 25th anniversary celebration picnic in Wheat Ridge, Colorado, at Denver Bible Church. So you're invited to that. Of course, that is free. And then Sunday morning at Denver Bible Church, Sunday school and worship and the sermon. We're going to have a wonderful time. We encourage you to come on out. And so until our next program, this is Bob Enyart for Fred Williams and Real Science Radio. May God bless you.
Intelligent design and DNA. Scholars can't explain it all away.